to the Seattle Kitchen Show. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rotura, the chef in a hat.
Katie O is on vacation in her place today. Tina Knoll will step in, our producer, and our assistant producer, Sarah Leibovitz, are both on the mic today. It might be a good day to ask some questions on our Facebook page, because Tina is in charge of that.
Yes.
She'll maybe be able to, if you know, we tape on Tuesday mornings here at the Hot Stove Society, and if you know that and you're listening online or what?
Via podcast.
Podcast.
Or
right
the Cairo
now.
Radio yeah. app. You can really listen to us anytime, anywhere you like.
Anywhere you like. Okay. We are here at the Hot Stove. I'm Tom Douglas, owner of several of Seattle's nicer restaurants, I like to think, in my own little head.
It is. And, they're nice, Tom.
Yes, indeed. Including the Dahlia Lounge, which is across the street. And I had dinner at the Dahlia the other night, and I tell you, we are kicking on all cylinders right now.
It's still rolling.
Well, you know, restaurants ebb and flow, but right now Brock is just kicking it, and I'm very, really proud of him. Also, Lola down here, which is Greek-inspired by my wife's grandparents.
Yummy breakfast.
Grandpa Louie.
If you ever run out of idea for breakfast.
And you, sir?
I have two restaurants. Also, I think they're pretty nice. Luc in Madison Valley at 28 and Madison, which is a French-American bistro. And downtown Seattle, Lule Kitchen Lule. And Bar at the corner of 6th and Union, bottom of the Sheraton.
We're going to learn about orchards with City Fruit today. They're the group that sets up people and arranges for houses and stuff in the urban environment to actually pick the fruit on these kind of wild apple trees or
like my tree,
like
my
your tree.
God.
But you pick your own fruit, but you could probably share it with others.
Oh, I could
That's
share.
What it's all about
so much apple.
We're going to talk food in the news about stolen avocados, vegan food rebranding, and more. Also, we're going to go toe to toe with tasty trivia. Not sure who our opponent is going to be yet.
Don't look at me.
We're still looking.
So we're thinking about that. But first, we're going to jump into Ordinary to Extraordinary. And Tina, do you know what Welsh rarebit is?
Nope. But you guys do, and I'm so excited to hear how you're going to make ordinary Welsh rarebit extraordinary using your wonderful culinary prowess.
Chef, have you ever made Welsh rarebit? I mean, why
no.
would you? You're French.
I made tons of rabbit in my life, but I don't know what Welsh rabbit is. What is Welsh
Well, it's
rabbit?
Not rabbit.
Not rabbit.
It's rarebit.
Oh, I see.
So we'll start there.
But let's start with rabbit.
How about we start with rabbit?
I was expecting a rabbit with some giant ears that would speak very funny.
Yeah.
No, that's not
like
the
English?
One. Yeah, English. Funny English, that is. A Welsh rabbit.
Yeah, how would you cook one of those?
Tell us how you would cook a rabbit, chef.
Oh, that's not a problem.
Whether it's
I would cut it in small pieces.
Yes.
You know, obviously it's dead already. Please. And I would
take the fur off.
I would take a big enamel Le Creuset pot or something similar to that. And it starts with butter. That's how you start. Brown butter. Take all your pieces that have been seasoned of rabbit. Season. Put them in the brown butter and keep turning them around until all the pieces are nice and beautifully brown. Then add some garlic, whole garlic peeled, sliced onion or pearled onion if you have pearled onion. And then a few carrots sliced, and then put the whole thing together, a little bit of white wine, some bay leaf, some thyme, cracked peppercorn, cover the whole thing, put it in the oven. 35, 40 minutes later, you pull that puppy out, and it's delicious. Serve over some beautiful white noodle, and you serve that rabbit right next to it with some fresh herbs sliced right on top of that at the end. All right, that was breakfast.
What's
what are we going to do
gonna
for lunch?
What's Disney going to do without all their characters?
Where would you get rabbit? Where would you even purchase rabbit?
Market has it.
Yeah, I mean, you go to Pike Place Market, to
Don Joe's.
You go to many different places. Rabbit is not unknown. Even Whole Foods. I've picked up rabbit at Whole Foods in their frozen section. The Arboretum, they're live, beautiful.
You know, I've seen more rabbits around recently in my neighborhood. It's been interesting. All of a sudden, they just kind of showed up.
They're all over Green Lake and Discovery Park.
Again, because they had cleared them out of Green Lake for a while. Yeah. So are they back?
Yeah, I've seen them.
And they reproduce very fast. Rabbits
no, those aren't the ones, just in case you're listening, we'll clarify, those aren't the ones that we're talking about.
No, of course not.
Do not hunt rabbits in Seattle.
But, so, Chef, here's the funny thing about what you just said. If you did everything you talked about but left out the rabbit...
Yeah.
You could almost get to rarebit. So you could take all those ingredients, the garlic and the onion and the herbs and blah, 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 and the white wine, and then you could melt cheese in it and put it over toast, and then you have Welsh rarebit.
I knew I was close.
So it's a little cheese sauce on toast, basically. So
wow.
That's and if you're going to do it and make it extraordinary, in my opinion, you know, when I've been in England, especially the southwest, the food is just bland. So anytime you could add fresh herbs, as we often say, because I feel like people just don't use fresh herbs enough.
No.
But it's hard to overdo it in a lot of ways. You could even just use fresh herbs and make an herb, you know, like a
pistou or a chamois.
Yeah, like an herb sauce. I mean, that's how much herbs you could use. But let's just say you're putting them into that cheese sauce that's going on your toast points or your toasted English muffin. That would be a way to make that more extraordinary.
Well,
and then it's also a good time, in my opinion, to clean out the cheese drawer, which we talk about. All those ends, you know, cut off the rinds of the brie, you cut off or camembert, cut off the ends of the parmesan.
Love cleaning the cheese drawer.
Yeah. So it's a good place to kind of stir everything together, just like I like to do with my
mac and cheese.
Well,
I learned something on this show. All right. You guys learned something, too?
Acorn squash. We just picked our first acorn squash at the farm and our first delicata squash. That's when you know fall is fast approaching, when those things
start. The leaves are turning slowly but surely.
My mom always made acorn squash. You know, cut them in half, take the seeds out, fill the center with gobs of, I think she used oleo, but I use butter, and brown sugar, and then just bake them, right? So you bake them upside down for a while to steam them. Then you turn them over, put the butter and brown sugar in, and then just finish them off.
They make a great soup. I mean, I think they make a delicious soup.
All squash really makes a great soup.
Yeah, exactly, because they're full of water, and you can cook them down, you can roast them. Mm-hmm. I think it's all about the spice you're going to use on it, you know, maybe a little cinnamon, a little bit of coriander, all those spices toasted, put that on the squash, mm-hmm. you know, and then blend the whole thing up. And then at the end, we were just talking about chamula. It's the end of summer where you have a lot of herbs in your garden that you need to start thinking of using because they're not going to make it through the winter. So all that beautiful basil and, you know, that anise hyssop and all that stuff you have in your backyard, take a whole bunch of it and blend it, add some chopped garlic, some olive oil, salt and pepper, and you've got a wonderful little pistou or nice little mm-hmm. chamula, and then put that on top of your soup. It's delicious.
Right. Or take them, make wedges, and caramelize them. Because squash is sweet, and it caramelizes beautifully in a hot oven. So, yum, I'm ready. I know it sounds weird to be ready for squash, because green beans are just really in their high season right now. But that's a good combination. Up next, Phil Klein of Nut Cheese Vineyard is here teaching us about sustainable wine on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show. We have a very lively audience today. And if they weren't, we just shamed them into it. I'm Tom Douglas, joined by the chef in the chapeau. Miss Katie O is on vacation. So if you were hoping to win an ice cream social today, you're not going to get it.
Well, we can always give it away. I mean,
I know we don't have to pay for it. Exactly. Phil Klein is here from Natchez Heights, outside of Ellensburg. And he is a vineyard specialist, biodynamic, and he's brought us some rocks today. Hi, Phil.
Good morning.
Good morning.
What are those rocks that you brought? They look very volcanic.
They are. I wanted to bring some examples of what is the geological formations of eastern Washington. So I brought an example of basalt, which is the primary lava form that is in the eastern Washington, and then I brought an example of andesite, which is a very rare feature in eastern Washington, and the reason I brought it is because I live on this andesite lava flow, mm-hmm. and they're very unique.
So, you know, I go to the Big Island every year for vacation in the winter, and I am very used to walking and golfing and beaching all through the lava. What's the difference between the lava here and the lava on the Big Island? Is it just younger on the Big Island that we're seeing?
Yeah, I think that's the primary difference. I can't imagine what this was like 11 million years ago when there was a huge hole in the ground with basalt just oozing out of it. Mm-hmm. I think that you get the same types of lava in Hawaii as you get here.
And then over the years, over the millions of years, the pressure just makes it more solid, like it becomes rock?
I think that the pressure, the gravitational force, but there's the way they cool is how they is the kind of how you base the density of that rock. And basalt is a little bit more medium viscous, and it cools a little slower. And when you see basalt cooling, you'll normally see it in columnar shapes.
The columnal basalt, right?
Absolutely. You get octagonal shapes or hexagons or those type of shapes. But andesite is more like what you see coming out of the lava, some of the modern or recent flows in Hawaii, or pillow lava. And so it's bulbous, round, and
sharp, too.
It is has a lot of silica in it, so it's quite it's low viscosity, and it creates a lot different flow. They're not normally known to be very long because they cool quickly and solidify. But the Natchez Heights area where I am, that lava flow, the Tyon lava flow, is perhaps the longest andesite lava flow in the world.
Huh.
It came out of the Goat Rocks about 1.5 million years ago and flowed up on top of the basalt that was already there. And my parents chose to live there back right after the Depression when they moved out from the Midwest. So I'm a lucky guy.
So that whole area we always have heard is shaped by the Missoula Glacier. So this is 1.5 million years ago. When did the glacier recede through that area?
That was recent, real recent in modern time. It was about 10,000 years ago.
Really?
And what's unique about where I am is that we started about 1,400 feet, and the Missoula floods were, the lakes that were formed were probably no higher than about 1,100 or 1,200 feet. So where I am has no influence from the Missoula floods, but everything east of me in the Yakima Valley that's below 1,100 feet is influenced by those ice dam breaking in Montana, and large amounts of water, I mean really large amounts of water, heading our way and ending up all the way out in the Willamette Valley of Oregon.
Stunning when you think
about
it.
Wow, I know. When you think of the size and the volume of that.
Yeah. They think that there was walls as high as 100 feet of water traveling at over 60 miles an hour, and it would have been as vast as you could have seen.
Wow.
Folks
like a tsunami, the same as a tsunami.
Folks that have been over into eastern Washington, they have the coulees out there where the basalt was solid enough, it stood its ground, but everything else got etched away, and they left these amazing geological features out there. Pretty unique.
So you do something unique. You do biodynamic wine?
I actually farm biodynamically on one of the vineyards that I manage in eastern Washington. That's Willridge Vineyard. That's about 2.5 miles from where I live, and it's been an interesting journey. I've been doing that for about 8-9 years now.
So what is biodynamic?
Biodynamics is a philosophy of farming that was started by Rudolf Steiner, and Steiner was a professor, scientist, and also a clairvoyant, which kind of probably heard him in the science community. But he came up with some methods for farming for his fellow Europeans, where they had been farming pretty much industrially using conventional man-made fertilizers and pretty much denuded much of the ground out there, and they were seeking answers. And his answer was to basically go organic, although he believed that everything was tied together from the farthest point in the universe to where we are, and we're all connected. And so it's a very holistic approach, but primarily organic, and we have seen some pretty interesting things come from it.
I'm sure you've read about Didier Dagneau, the French winemaker, who was 100% just like that.
Yes, yeah.
Called crazy by many, but produced some incredible wine.
Yes, that's what we're all looking for, is a really nice finished product, and how we get there, that belief system. Really, the organic soil science revolution that's going on right now, I think, is going to be really healthy for all of us.
Right.
I think, unfortunately, we've all been kind of led a big kind of fabrication about what's healthy for us to eat. So there's a lot for us to learn, and thank you guys for farming with fresh vegetables and, doing all that.
That's what happens when Madison Avenue gets involved in farming, is that we end up getting sold things that aren't necessarily good for us.
Right.
So why do grapes in particular? Oh, so we only have 2 minutes. Why do grapes in particular love this kind of basalt? This kind of
well, Eastern Washington is blessed because of the sun, the water, and the soils that we have there. One of the reasons why I wanted to kind of point out this andesite was I worked with a biodynamic consultant by the name of Philippe Amier for a couple of years, and one of the things that Steiner believed that was that quartz or silica was very important in drawing the energy of the cosmos, and andesite is about 50% silica, so it's feldspar, mica, and so he told me when he got there, he looked around at the rocks and he goes, holy cow, you're a heat sink for the cosmic energy because of this andesite that you're sitting on. I think that anybody that farms organically has to be very proactive and really has to pay attention to what's going on. And we are very happy to have gone that way from a conventional program where my father and grandfather started. But I think it really helps with the wine and what we're growing. I think you, first off, it's safer for the environment. It's safer for the microorganisms in the soil. And I think my wines kind of speak for that with the softness and elegance of the mouthfeel.
Thanks, Phil Klein from Natchez Heights Vineyards. We are going to have you join us for another segment next week and talk about your wines themselves. And I'm looking forward to that because I want to see how the grapes actually present themselves through the biodynamic process.
Right.
You're in the Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio. Everyone in the audience is getting a little taste of the biodynamic wine from Phil Klein. It is, it's going to be a wonder if Tina makes it around the room without running out of wine. So we're going to keep an eye on it. We're going to keep an eye on it. This is very, very clear.
Updates to come.
Updates to come. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
And Sarah is sitting in for Katie today. And Sarah, there's always something trending in the restaurant world, and it's always kind of a question whether or not it should be or not. And I tend to be the glasses half full or half empty in this neighborhood, and I think Chef Terry is more the glasses half full in this neighborhood.
That's right. And so, also, I like the fact that Sarah is the one doing the research because she's much younger than we are, and she looks at it very differently.
That's true, because what could be trending for us and what we think is foolish could be right up her alley.
Exactly.
Matter of fact, most likely is.
Oh, yeah, you think so?
The more we don't like it, the more you like it.
That's how it goes, right?
So what do you have on your list of things that are trending, and we'll give you our thoughts on whether or not it deserves that treatment.
All right, yeah. This is a list that Bon Appetit put together of some of their favorite trends of 2018 so far. And some of them I had heard of, and some of them I hadn't really thought too much about. But I know one that we discussed briefly last week and wanted to get more into is that breakfast sandwiches are getting chefy. Basically, that breakfast sandwiches are now everywhere and a lot fancier than they used to be, you know, adding avocados, fried eggs, Gouda, things like that. And I know we do, in fact, have some chefy breakfast sandwiches, considering we eat one here every single week.
Every week. Comes with your $15 ticket.
There you go.
And it's well worth it, I got
to
say.
I think there is nothing wrong with that. To me, I think, I mean, you know, to add some beautiful tomato or some great avocados onto a breakfast sandwich, good for them. I mean, if it's done correctly, it's beautiful.
When I first was a young person going into restaurants, that was my first meals in restaurant were the breakfast sandwiches at the local diner, right? You go in, you get an egg on white or
right,
egg with cheese
right.
on white. Every kind of Greek American restaurant in New York City got the coffee, the bad coffee, and the bad breakfast sandwich.
Yep.
And then I think McDonald's is the one who kind of popularized it. They were looking for a way to extend their hours of service. We at the Dolly Bakery, we've been serving breakfast sandwiches now for close to 15, 18 years, I want to say, on our homemade English muffins. And they are more popular than ever. I don't know if they've gotten more chefy than ever because cheese, egg, bacon is pretty much the standard.
I think then it's all in the standard quality than you've set for your sandwich.
I agree.
The bread.
The English muffin
the
is
muffin,
homemade. Yeah.
That muffin, to me, I think is what makes the sandwich. I mean, it's true for any sandwich. if the bread is not very good, I mean, white bread has never been a very popular item. If you can change white bread to a nice sourdough bread, you know, a nice Italian country sourdough bread, you're going to have a gorgeous sandwich.
Right.
That just up the sandwich a mile up.
And yet my mother would always pick the white bread over a country loaf like that. So that's
yeah,
just,
well,
depends on
word,
how you were brought up.
There's a
oh,
word
yeah.
for everybody, yeah.
So I'm not sure if they're more chefy. I just think that the chefy part is making them from scratch.
Right. Yeah. They're just getting more popular as a result. So going on to the next one, they're saying ice is the new ice cream. That icy, and I've seen these around town as well, that things like ice slushies or a Korean dessert called bingsu, shaved ice, are becoming a lot more popular and ice cream a little bit less.
I think that's regional, I gotta say. Yeah. When I was going on dates as a high schooler, we used to always go to Rita's Water Ice in downtown Wilmington, Delaware. And, I mean, they're all over the place now, but it's just a much lighter, more refreshing, especially summertime, kind of sweet. So I don't know if it's the new hot trend. Granitas have been around forever.
Yeah, granitas have been around forever. And the Hawaiian ice. I mean,
Hawaiian ice, yeah.
It's been there forever, and it's delicious. You know, I think it very much the surrounding is what caters to that kind of behavior, I think.
And with the Hawaiian ice, I've noticed that you're starting to see places that are actually making homemade raspberry syrup, homemade.
Yeah, they make their own stuff.
Rather
as
than
opposed to just using those bottles and.
Yeah, with dye, 13 different colors of dye and.
Would you like some blue syrup?
Yeah, and fake flavors. So, trending, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got to say, I'm from New York where it's much colder in the winter. I don't know that this is trending there. I'd have to go back and check, I guess. Along those same lines, well, kind of. We're switching out, or they're saying that we're switching out booze with gazaz, which is not what I had typically heard of it called as, but they're calling it gazaz, a refreshing drink made with sparkling water, fruit syrup, and fresh herbs. Mm-hmm. I would have just called that a shrub.
A shrub, although there's no vinegar aspect.
Right.
Okay.
When I think of shrubs having some sort of mother
acid.
Of vinegar acid aspect to it.
Right.
So.
Yeah. I have no idea if that's a trend or not. I mean, I
well,
don't.
It's been trending for 30
I mean,
years.
Yeah, it's been existing for a few years, and I don't know if it's a trend.
So let's say no on that.
No,
yeah, no trend.
I feel like I do see them more on restaurant menus, though. Like instead of just like having their drinks being like you know soda, just the regular things, they'll have like a homemade section.
Well, I think the non-alcoholic section has definitely ramped up tremendously in most restaurants. They. You know, we try to satisfy the need of people who want non-alcoholic. And mostly, I think it's due to the fact that we want to be more interesting, but also it makes a better sell. You know,
well,
you're selling
that, and it's definitely more interesting saying I have Coke, Sprite, or
yeah, exactly.
You know, root beer,
right.
I guess. And maybe, you know, that even started with some of these soda companies that started to try and make a higher quality soda, dry soda.
Absolutely.
Thomas Kemper root beer, that was 20 years ago and very fun to have in the restaurant. You could almost get it on tap if you wanted. But
it's fun to have your people behind the bar making non-alcoholic mocktail, we call them. I mean, that's always fun, you know, fresh herb, fresh fruit, little soda, and boom, you get a nice little cocktail that's different than what you can get on the... You know.
I got one for you, Sarah.
Yeah.
It says here, Grandma's wallpaper has made a comeback. Now, if you were designing your own kitchen right now or living room, would you put Grandma's wallpaper in? Is that attractive to you?
No.
The thing is, your grandmother used to wallpaper. Her grandmother's
my age.
Did not use wallpaper.
Yeah, exactly.
My grandmother is a lovely 81 years old.
Uh-huh.
So she's at least not a little older than you. Mm-hmm. And she did have wallpaper.
A little.
You know, just a couple
maybe like
years.
Maybe like 21 years.
Yeah. You know,
thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely see grandmother's decor making a comeback in clothing and in like little like items like rugs or things like that. I don't know if I would cover my entire wall in that design, though. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we've quite reached that point.
I feel like I've seen a lot of women lately wearing sort of vintage house dresses, that kind of look.
Oh, yeah.
Which I think is really sweet and fun, and it's very much a... I'll call it a millennial look. I don't know what else to call that group, but that's a very large group. But.
I think they went and reached out in the fashion industry. They went and reached out further back because they used to go back to the disco time and come back, and now they're going back to the grandma
time. Maybe it's the hipster group. Maybe it's the group before the millennials, the hipsters,
the 90s.
are starting to wear vintage dresses.
I'm down with that. Yeah.
Does every? I wonder if every generation goes through that. Of course they do.
So I should keep my bell bottom.
How about you, Chef? Do you consider that celebrities count as restaurant decor? So, for example, like you go to L.A. and you know that this restaurant a lot of celebrities go to. Do you go there because a lot of celebrities go
there? So, in L.A., it is definitely true because I lived in L.A. for 5 years. And, you know, they definitely put them in the center stage. Like, look who's here tonight. You know,
but do you think a restaurant builds its reputation because they attract celebrities?
Correct. Okay. In L.A., yes. Mm-hmm. In Seattle, I don't think that stuff exists. I think we make a point here to subdue that quite well. Uh-huh. We put them in the back. They want to be quiet. No, I don't think. I mean, I don't.
So there's not one local celeb that you think people would say, "God, I heard that Eddie Vedder's hanging out at Lule. I'm going to go have dinner at Lule."
By the way, he does. So you should show up every day. That's what I do. Oh, but well, he's not. You know, we hide him upstairs in the private room. No, I don't. Do you know of a restaurant in Seattle that does
that?
Well,
I know, for example, we still get, all these years later, we still get people that walk in the front door at the Dahlia, talk to the host and say, I want to sit in the booth where Tom Hanks sat in Sleepless in Seattle. And that's 25 years ago.
That is a special thing, I think. That's not the same as saying, I'm going to go to eat in this restaurant because there is celebrities in this restaurant every night. It's a little bit different. That's a one-star moment there.
I will say, I used to eat at Elaine's in New York, 92nd, and I want to say 2nd or 3rd on the East Upper East Side in Manhattan. And it was very mediocre Italian food, but it was such a scene that I enjoyed going there. You always saw tons of celebrities. It was, and Elaine was kind of the card herself. She was this big woman who used to work the dining room and, you know, sit down with all the celebs. And she was just a card. And so I would say, the celebs are the part of the atmosphere there that makes it more fun.
Right. When you're visiting those places, it's totally great to know where they are and to go see it. But no, I don't think we have that much existing in Seattle. And if there is anybody who knows otherwise, let me know. I'll go check it out.
All right, we're going to answer your culinary quandaries up next when we tackle questions from our listeners on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. All right, welcome to the Seattle Kitchen Show. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Roturo, the chef in the hat.
Keena Knoll is here today, sitting in for KDO, as well as Sarah is. And Tina, you went on to our sites.
Our Facebook page, Seattle Kitchen, where people often like to go and ask us a culinary question.
Does anyone ever ask on Instagram?
No.
No. Why is that?
Because they mostly post pictures on Instagram.
Does anyone ever want to Snapchat live with me?
Yes. Everybody wants to do that.
Okay.
All the time.
Just saying.
Yep. And Chef Terry as well.
I feel left out.
You know, people love hearing from you, really. So when you hop on our Facebook page and play around, I think people really enjoy that. So.
Well, apparently last week, people got upset that I didn't like banana splits.
Quite a controversy surrounding the banana split. Yep.
So truth be told, I have a company Facebook, but I personally have never posted on Facebook before in my whole life. So I'm sitting at the bar at Lule. You send me a text saying, you should really jump into this conversation. So we get on the Terry's Facebook account and we do a whole... We do a whole scenario about me having a split personality.
Which was very cute.
And we post it, but what?
Well, you guys need a little lesson on the posting.
Okay.
we kind of knew that. We were both like, I don't even know.
Where is it? I can't find it. We posted it. Where is it?
They're cute. Like, okay, so we're going to do a lesson on Facebook, and we will put Tom Douglas and Terry Roturo in... Available
in direct,
so that you can actually do some interfacing with them. We'll do this lesson with you guys so that next week people can hop on our Facebook page and check it out. The first question I have for you, though, actually came via the Cairo Radio inbox, and this is somebody who's not super happy with you, Tom. His name's Don.
Join the crowd.
His name is Don, and Don says he just learned of your 20% service charge at your restaurants, and he shall no longer be listening to the show. And
well, then why are we even talking about his question? He's not going to hear the answer.
I suspect when I used to work with Dave Ross, everybody who said, I'm never listening again, the following week, I'm never listening again. Oh, look, it's Kay from Seattle again. She's still not listening. He also says he shall do everything he can to dissuade anyone and any company you are associated with from having anything to do with your establishment.
Wow.
He's mad about the 20%.
Yeah, I guess he is.
Yeah.
Well, Don, number one, I would say you should get a life.
Yeah.
Number two, I would say... you have to understand the service charge first,
yeah.
And I'm happy to explain it. We have a card at each of the restaurants that explains, no, you're not going to edit that out.
I'm cutting the get a life.
No, that's you're not.
Okay.
It's, you know, he's got to, what kind of mean person would go around and say, I'm going to dissuade everyone. Just don't come.
Right.
It's okay.
Right.
It's all right. Well, I don't know why people have to be that way. Life's too short. I'm certainly a nice person, as Chef.
Absolutely, I'll vouch for him.
If you disagree with me, don't come, but don't be an idiot about it.
Right.
Anyway, so the waiters themselves are on commission, just like a tip, and some of the service charge goes to pay for their benefits, which I believe in. I certainly pay for most of their benefits, and it is also.
Yeah.
A way for sick and safe pay. There's a lot of reasons for it. And I personally, in my restaurant group, have to pay a lot more money than Terry does right now per hour because the minimum wage...
is already at 15. You've been at 15 for over a year now, right?
I've been at 15 for close to 5 years now.
5 years, yeah.
So
because you made that a personal choice in
yes,
the restaurant.
Yes, exactly. So... Yeah. Until everything evens up, I had to even up. I can't charge $40 for a chicken. That's all there is to it. Okay, next.
Right.
Since
so,
he's not listening, I'm not going to go drone on.
Right, done. All righty, on to something a little bit lighter. What? This is from Callista.
Oh, and I will say.
Yeah. I knew he wasn't done.
Carry on.
One of the things that came with that service charge was, if you don't like the service, you don't have to sit there and think, God, do I leave 10% or do I leave 12%? Because, man, she really messed up tonight. You don't pay. You don't pay for the service, and you don't pay for the dinner. That's our 100% guarantee. So if that doesn't satisfy you, what else do I have to do? You know?
Exactly. Alrighty. So Callista from our Facebook...
And another... No, just kidding.
Callista from our Facebook page asks, what is the secret to making a perfect poached egg? She says she's tried multiple times, but the egg whites seem to fall apart.
Chef, you want to handle this one?
You know, they make tools for that. You know, you go to the
go on.
You go to the sur la table, and you buy one of those egg poacher tools where you put the egg inside the egg poacher. You put that in the water; it never goes away. Your white stays exactly there, and you'll never have that issue again.
It looks like you bought it from a vendor, though. It doesn't look natural.
Well,
you know, it looks like the shape of the cup you put it in.
We're trying to solve her issue here. She's
okay.
Got the egg whites spreading
everywhere.
Well,
what's everywhere. The simpler? So, you know, you take the water. You don't.
So here's how I do a poached egg. I put salt and vinegar in the water. I swirl the water. I crack my egg and I put it straight into the water. And usually I don't have much issue. There will always be a little bit of white that will seep around. But in general, it stays coagulated together.
Mm-hmm.
And
you never boil, right? It's
you
only
never
at the
boil, which is
center.
Also maybe an issue than she has, because if you boil the water, the white will definitely fall apart right away, because it's the first thing that will break down is the white. The yolk's going to coagulate and be stronger if you boil your water, but most importantly, your white's going to be everywhere. So maybe she's going too high on the heat.
Okay.
All right. Alexi asks from our Facebook page, how can I spice up kale and spinach?
Salt and pepper and chili pepper. Yes. Sorry.
Turn down the lights.
Turn down the lights.
Spice it up.
Invite somebody over for dinner.
Turn on some music.
So she wants to know how to spice up her kale.
Your kale and spinach. Yeah,
well,
what are some
you know,
spices?
If she's not vegetarian, there's a great way to start your kale, and that's with bacon. And if you put diced bacon and sliced onion, you know, once your bacon is rendered, you put sliced onion in there. You caramelize the whole thing. Then you put your kale in there. You melt it slowly. And you can even add a little bit of chicken stock or vegetable stock, whatever you're doing. And braise those greens very quickly. You'll have a wonderful dish mm-hmm. in your hand.
You can add things like craisins or pine nuts, toasted
yep.
pine nuts,
yep.
some garlic, some red chili flake. It'll become a much more of like that Italian kind of sautéed spinach that you
right.
you see around town quite a bit. So.
And you know what? Cream has never killed anybody. You know, oh. you're doing
creamed kale.
What?
Oh, Tom, believe me, this is where I was raised. We use shoe, those leaves of kale,
a
those
shoe?
Big leaves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we make shoe braisé.
Your mother could make anything tender. She even made shoes tender.
With crème fraîche. I mean, it's like you put a dollop of that kind of sour cream at the end. Oh, man, it's delicious.
Okay, your last question from Deborah. When is the best time for peaches and where are the best peaches? Because they are her favorite
you're
fruits.
Almost missing the boat. This is ruining it right now.
Yeah, if you're
it's at the end of a... It's at the end of the season, and then if you can find them now, you should definitely buy a few more than what you need and cut them in half, put them in the freezer, and keep them for later, or poach them in a nice little simple syrup, which is water and a bit of sugar, and bring it to a boil. Put your peaches in there. Put a towel on top so they get all submerged. You know, you put a wet towel on top of your peaches so they stay below the water level so they don't gray on the outside and yellow on the inside. And you'll have wonderful peach poach in your refrigerator, and you can keep that for quite a few days in your refrigerator and make peach melba, which is vanilla ice cream, poached peach, a little bit of raspberry or strawberry coulis on top, toasted almond. Voila. A classic.
And I would say there's nobody who's tackled the peach issue like Met Markets has.
Yeah.
There's five or six Met Markets in the area, and they have a peach program.
Peacharama
that they started years ago, and it really is spectacular. And you can walk in, unlike a lot of places, you can walk in and get ripe peaches right now for tonight.
Right. And there's often someone standing there slicing them, and you can try the
it's
peaches
just not
and nectaries
fair.
And all of that. I love it.
It's not fair. You put one of those in your mouth, how do you not buy a whole box of those peaches?
I
just think that there should be a law against tasting perfect food like that because you're unable to control yourself.
And they also make a great chutney with a little bit of vinegar, salted onions. Mm, you know, keep that for your pork chop or your roast later on in the winter or in the fall.
I make a peach sambal with fresh peaches, sour shrimp paste, and toasted peanuts.
Ooh.
Delicious. All right, up next, it's our Taste of the Week on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show. Everyone's got their Dahlia Bakery breakfast sandwich here this morning, which they get with their $15 ticket along with hot coffee, which quite the deal, I think.
It is the deal of the city.
I am Chef Tom Douglas. We're heading into our second hour. We still have food in the news, including should you or should you not be eating Puget Sound Chinook salmon? There's a big debate going on out there. I think I have a rational approach to it. I don't know. Stolen avocados. There's all kinds of things coming up. Our Taste of the Week, the Seattle Cider Company and City Fruit. We're going to talk about them. And then we're going to wrap up the show with our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge.
And should be easy today. KDO is not here.
KDO is not here, so we should win. But this young Sarah, I believe, is going to be our opponent today.
Oh, perfect. And we actually have a guest, Ken from Geeks Who Drink, who's going to be quizzing us. So who knows what these questions are going to be.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so very interesting.
The Geeks Who Drink, is that the one that does the trivia at Tanaka-san or at Brave Horse?
They do it at Assembly Hall
Yeah, Tanaka-san, Assembly Hall, same thing. Wow. All right. Taste of the Week. I'll go first.
Go ahead.
Because I have this, I look forward to this taste every year, and it happens to be in mid-season form right now, and that is the Hatch Chili Bratwurst at Shoreline Central Market. I believe they sell them throughout the chain. There's a Central Market in Paulsbow and Mill Creek and Shoreline, and then, of course, there's the Ballard Market. It's been there forever. But they roast the Hatch chilies. You can buy just the plain chilies roasted, or you can buy them done in a couple of different ways. I like the Hatch chili and cheese bratwurst. They are trashy good and delicious. And I ate three of them last night, which I think was a pound of bratwurst.
Dang.
Huh.
That's
and the good news is I ate them with a little vegetable stir fry, you know, like broccoli.
Oh, sure.
I did. Dig.
2 liters of spinach.
But the brats, I just could not stop. The package comes with three. What am I supposed to do? Put one in the fridge?
Save them?
Yeah. Put one in the freezer, Tom.
Really?
Oh, yeah, for the future.
I'm not going to put a single weenie in the fridge.
I get it. It's just a little bit exaggeration, but it's good. Some once in a while, you know.
Yeah.
But then you didn't even go work out this morning.
I just like the roasted nature of that chili in there. They got a mild spice, but a little bit more than just a mild spice.
But they have a very rich, deep flavor, which is
like
what's so cool about it.
So check out the Hatch Chili Bratwurst right now. They are going strong at the Central Market locations. And that wasn't a paid advertisement, by the way.
No.
All right. Good to know.
I just like
them. Check.
I think it's fun. I'm glad they take advantage of the season.
I had a nice little plate of radishes and goat butter. Have you had goat butter, Tom?
I have.
It was absolutely fantastic and reminded me how goat butter is delicious. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it sounds kind of weird or whatever, but it was unctuous. It was, the butter itself was just magic. It was so beautiful. There was no funky flavor. Mm-hmm. You know,
was it not, salted butter?
Yeah, it was a little salt actually on top.
Okay.
But it was from a farm in California, and I'm sorry, I don't remember the name of it. But it was delicious. Mm-hmm. It was really a good flavor that I have forgotten about.
You know, that is such a popular thing these days, radishes with butter. And I know it's very en français.
Yeah.
How? How did that get started?
I
love it. I'm not disparaging it.
One of the memory, photographic memory of my youth was walking in the first house my parents lived in where I was born. And my dad would walk in the backyard with a piece of bread, his pocket knife that he would always have, and a big hunk of butter on top of the bread. Mm-hmm. And he'd walk into the garden. We'd be talking. And he'd pick radishes out of the ground, just wash them off with his hand, and then slice it, put it on his bread, and then eat that as we were talking.
This was just always a French thing.
I know. It must be a French thing. I mean, but I remember that very vividly. And you know, it's very interesting because I've always loved radishes and butter and bread. Who doesn't like that?
Now,
you
I
get
like
that
the...
nice little piquant. You get the sweetness and richness of the butter.
Uh-huh.
And then that sourness from the bread. It's delicious.
The last time I made it at home, I whipped the butter with an Alderwood smoked salt.
Yeah, that
so it's like
good.
A little bit of a salty, smoky.
Uh-huh.
That was a cow's milk butter,
right?
I like that combination too with a spicy radish.
And then I have another taste.
Okay.
Yesterday we did the Rover's pop up like we do every 3 months, and I did a rockfish, and I haven't done a rockfish in quite some time, and baked it for about 3 minutes. They were about a half an inch thick. Baked it for about 3 minutes at 450 degrees in the oven, just salt and pepper on it, and serve, of course, all kinds of things with it. A succotash of corn, sauteed onions, and what else was in there?
Essentially, the fish was plain.
Right.
Yeah.
And the fish was it was absolutely beautiful. It came in that morning from Niabe. It was fresh, gorgeous filet, beautiful and firm.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God, I forgot how delicious that fish is. I want to encourage people to buy fresh rockfish.
There you go.
It's delicious.
Tina, do you have a taste today, or Sarah?
I sure do. I had a lovely dish at Bar Ferdinand on Capitol Hill.
Is that upper bar or the regular Bar Ferdinand?
I think it's the regular Bar Ferdinand, right there.
Merrill's Market?
Yeah. No. No.
Oh.
Now like where the Cloud Room is.
Oh, yeah. So that's the signal.
Upper Bar Ferdinand.
Upper Bar Ferdinand.
Okay. Behind Marmite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the atmosphere there, I have to say, is just makes the dish. But I had a burrata with chanterelle mushrooms and, you know, a little bit of basil in there, drizzled with some delicious olive oil, and it was spectacular.
They have a wood oven there, and I like how simple they cook there.
Right.
That's one of my favorite things.
Clean, lovely, simple, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
My taste of the week, and Terry, I've got to say, the radishes on bread is one of my favorite breakfasts. I eat it a lot for breakfast. But along the same lines,
what about the butter part?
Do you butter, too.
Oh, okay.
Oh, of course.
Okay.
All of it. It's just a bakery that I love going to every week at the farmer's market in Ballard, and it's Seawolf Bakers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Their rye sourdough is one of my favorite breads, especially for things like placing radishes on top of. Something I made this week that I really liked is I bought some fresh zucchinis and tomatoes and bacon, and then just sautéed them all together and piled them on top of a piece of bread, and it was like perfect summer food for me. Super easy.
That bakery does a tremendous job. They make a little Olivetta type of bread there, too, that I just...
Right.
I'll eat the whole thing. By the time I stroll all the way around that Ballard farmer's market, I'll eat that whole loaf of bread. And it's great when it's going down, but, man, you feel it.
They have the most delicious-looking cinnamon rolls there, too.
Up next, we're going to talk about the Seattle Cider Company and City Fruit on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show. We have a very lively audience today. How is the wine out there, everybody? Phil's wine tasted good this morning for everyone. Good. I'm glad to hear that. He's sitting right behind you, so I wouldn't say anything otherwise.
And that big knife is in use.
We are joined by Scott Katzma, head cider maker from the Seattle Cider Company, Carrie Ferrance with City Ferrance. With City Fruit Company, City Fruit Organization, and Mara Hardman, also with the Seattle Cider Company. And we're going to talk about harvesting the extra food that we have in our neighborhoods, and then we're going to jump into where that fruit is going first. So, Carrie, why don't you jump on the mic and tell us about City Fruit and what people can do to join your program,
yeah.
Or if they have a tree right now and they're not signed up, can they still sign up?
Yeah, so... Not everyone knows this, but Seattle has one of the largest canopies of urban fruit trees in the country. So we spend about 5 to 6 months out of our year picking fruit and sharing most of it back out with our community partners. Right now we're harvesting apples and pears. We just are also wrapping up plums. But we also harvest persimmons, kiwi, figs. There's a lot of fruit growing in the city. A lot of it was planted like 100 years ago or 50 years ago, and the trees are not just going, they're actually producing more than they did 50 years ago. So it's an incredible resource, not just in food, but also the legacy and the history of this city. And a lot of it is going to waste. A lot of the fruit is falling to the ground. We started about 10 years ago in an effort to ensure that the fruit is collected, it is preserved, and it is shared with food banks, senior centers, youth programs. The vast majority of the tens of thousands of pounds of fruit that we harvest every year is shared back with our community. Our goal is to ensure that it is put to its fullest use and that everyone in our city has access to it.
And I think your goal, too, is to have sell some to make your program self-sustaining, right?
Yeah. So about 80 to 90% of the fruit that we collect is shared with our community partners and with our members and supporters. We send a lot of really ugly fruit to Seattle Cider, which is an exciting partnership. And then we save some of our fruit for our restaurant partners, of course, of which Tom Douglas Group is a big partner. And that fruit is put into baked goods, into meals, into ice cream all over the city. So it's a really fun way to explore some of the flavors that we don't find in grocery stores. We don't even find in farmers markets. They're really unique to this city.
What's the most exotic thing you've come across? And then before we cut you off, I want to know, can people still join your program?
Yeah, thank you for that. Looping back around on that. So my favorite thing that we harvest are kiwis. We don't see a ton of them, but what is growing is pretty productive. Last year, the most popular photo that we had on social media was a 600-pound harvest of kiwis. And actually, it wasn't a 600-pound harvest. It was a much larger harvest than that, but that was what we got. So the tree owner or the plant harbor owner had collected like 1,000 pounds of kiwis, shared most of it with her neighbor, set up recipes on her front porch. I mean, this fruit was available for all. We got the last 600 pounds of it, and we were really excited to share that. And it's actually, we're seeing some of that fruit even later in the year, sometimes around November. We work with hundreds of tree owners across the city. There are probably fruit trees on every block of this city, in front yards, backyards, right-of-ways, and in public orchards. And if you have a tree and you need help putting some of the fruit to its best use, or even all of its fruit to its best use, you can register your tree on cityfruit.org. We'll add you into the mix. And if you also just have some extra fruit, we can drop off a collection box that you can fill and we'll pick up later.
You know, I have a kiwi in my backyard, and when I moved in, it was doing fine. And then the one of them died, and of course, you have to have a male and a female in the kiwi. We went to Swanson's. They swore it was a female.
No.
And now I have two males and no kiwis.
You gotta keep going.
Or two females.
Double
I'm not
down.
Sure which
double
is the
down.
Double down. Exactly. All right, Seattle Cider is here. You're buying this fruit, which in turn helps keep City Fruit alive because they have to have funding. I love this idea that a nonprofit like City Fruit can actually fund its own way. You don't have to do big benefits. The fruit is paying its way. And also ending up in the food bank, which I think is tremendous. So tell us about Seattle Cider. How'd you get connected with City Fruit, and what are you doing with their fruit?
So, yeah, we're not actually buying the fruit. They're bringing fruit to us that they can't donate.
Oh, okay. So it's the ugly fruit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Same
it's all
thing.
The wormy stuff.
Yeah.
It's the stuff that hits the ground and they can't give to the food bank because
right.
it's touched the ground. So this is stuff that would otherwise be compost.
You have to get rid of, right? You have to pay to get rid of, so you're actually saving them money.
Yes.
So you're buying in an odd way.
Yes. But then we're making a cider and then donating half of the proceeds back to support annual harvest.
Love that.
Yeah. So I think when we started, their harvest of apples was about 68% viable. And in 2015, the first year that they started bringing us fruit and I made a cider for them, we took it to about 98% of a viable harvest and composted only about 2%.
Uh-huh. So I think of cider having to have all sorts of kinds of kind of heirloom apples mm-hmm. or this and that to give it its qualities. How do you decide and how do you know what fruit's coming in? Because they're from trees all over the place.
Yeah, sure. And there's probably over 40, 50 varietals in this cider. We don't really even know. But like Carrie was talking about, most of these trees were planted 50, 100 years ago. So they actually are older fruits. They aren't the new culinary apples that are being put in the ground like Cosmic Crisp, which they planted over like 500,000 acres of last year, mm-hmm. which is supposed to be the new magical apple. These are actually like old world French English style varietals that were brought over, you know, 100 years ago.
And maybe even for that reason, maybe even for cider.
Yep.
So what makes one of these apples better than, say, the Cosmic Crisp, which I think of as a table apple?
Sure.
And then you're using these other apples for other qualities.
Yeah, most grocery store varietals or culinaries are sweets or sharps. And the older world apples are bitter sweets or bitter sharps, which usually mean they have higher acid and higher tannin.
Which is perfect for cider.
Yes, exactly. And so it has been something that we've been able to work on, working with Luke, who is their orchard manager. If they do have extra time to harvest, he'll ask me what types of apples we should be out there looking for. And the first year, he didn't bring us any crab apples. He didn't pick any crab apples because he was like, who wants those? And so when he found out, when he told me, he's like, that when I found out they have crab apples, I was like, yes, bring me all the crab apples. So
they're super sour, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Super acidic and have a lot more tannin than just like your normal.
Yeah, they do great fermentation. I mean,
yes.
That's cool.
Yep.
Mara, what are we drinking here? Well, you've poured us a nice glass of lovely cider.
Absolutely. So this is the Seattle Cider 2016 vintage. This came out in 2017. So the City Fruit team will harvest the apples, and then we, of course, make them into cider. And then we release that later so that we're able to sell the product. And it's kind of fun, too, because we get to tell the story about City Fruit from another avenue. They get a little bit more visibility from our social channels. We get to talk about it. And we're having this amazingly hyper-local Seattle cider that's mm-hmm. made from fruit trees and in people's backyards.
And this is raw cider, right? This is there's alcohol?
Yes, not raw cider.
I just want to make sure. Cider. I'm not just buzzing for nothing.
Right, this is 6.3. This is a 6.3 ABV, a nice low brick, so it's not overly sweet.
It's very delicious. The finish is absolutely beautiful.
I know. Terry, I'm not much of a cider person, but I love this. For some reason, this strikes my palate differently. I find a lot of ciders maybe even too sour or too tart for me. This, to me, is well-balanced and lovely. So.
Right.
Pairs well with many things.
Even though it's an apple, it pairs well with many
things. Oh, I see what you did there. So we did want to note that we have our release coming up. The Seattle Cider City Fruit release for the 2017 vintage is coming up on September 15th. And that's from 1 to 9 p.m. It's in the Wood Cider House and Tasting Room in SoTo. So we'd love to have people come out. That's a great place to pick up some City Fruit and support what they're doing. Pick up the cider, try it. We do tastings. You can come out and meet some folks who work with City Fruit, some of their volunteers. So,
yeah. Is it a ticketed event or not?
It's not. It's free. It is 21 plus. Uh-huh. It is a 21 plus event. We do allow dogs in the tasting room, mm-hmm. though, so that's fun. You might meet some furry friends there.
All right, go check out the Seattle Cider Company and try some of this release from City Fruit Apples. Thank you, Carrie Ference. Can't seem to do that right. Thank you, Scott Katzma and Mara Hardman from Seattle Cider Company.
Thank you.
All right. Terry.
Yes, Tom.
We're going to hit food in the news when we come back.
Uh-huh.
And should you stop eating salmon to save the orcas? That's kind of the question that's been coming into my emails fast and furious over the last couple of weeks. And we're going to check that out next on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. We are back in the Seattle kitchen. I'm Tom Douglas, coming to you from the Hot Stove Society. Just a half hour left of the show here. We have food in the news and, of course, our Foods for Thought Tasty Trivia coming up next. The first food in the news I wanted to get to was the big conversation going on about the orcas in the Sound and their preference for Chinook salmon? And should we, as restaurateurs, stop serving Puget Sound or Puget Sound area Chinook salmon? And I think I've thought about this a lot, and I know Renee Erickson's been on the in the media a lot about it. Where do you stand, Chef?
No, of course we can live without the eating the king salmon for repopulating the well. It's absolutely fine. I have no problem with that. We have plenty of coho to eat and plenty of silver around. We have plenty of pink. We have plenty of other salmon. We have delicious salmon. Not everything should be king, just like not everything should be filet mignon. It's the same thing.
So there's many folks that have come out saying this is stupid. We don't eat nearly enough salmon to make a difference, or enough king salmon to make a difference. All that sort of thing. My take is that there's many silos that depend on that fish, right? There's seals, sea lions, orcas are the most natural ones that we hear about, which eat many more king salmon than we as humans eat out of the Sound.
Correct.
There's the Indian fisheries, the sport fisheries. I don't think there's much commercial fishery, except maybe out in Nia Bay. There might still be some commercial fishery of Chinook. There's really not a lot of those silos, the pressure on the fish. The orcas can't change to what they eat.
Mm-hmm.
The sea lions eat what they eat. We can't solve that. Even though we don't eat enough to make a difference, as been told to me by a UW professor, it's still, I feel like we are the ones capable of
making
a
difference.
A choice.
Yeah, of course.
Whereas maybe some other species can't make a choice. Our species can make a choice.
Right.
And I don't see the harm in at least publicly, you know what I'm saying, like setting an example
and
of not eating the local Chinook at this point.
Yeah, so. And all rising population is what has created the disturbance in their feeding in the first place.
So
all the noise, all the poison, everything that's already affecting their life.
So I just wanted to be clear. Yes, I do recognize that the amount that we're taking is not enough to make a difference, logically. But in my mind, ceremonially, mm-hmm. it's enough to make a difference
right.
in how we look at it and how we act as humans and as a species guardian. So,
and I would say before we say it doesn't make a difference, let's do it and see what happens. You know, we're going to collect the data.
I get it.
It's fine.
So we have decided also to not serve local Chinook, and that is the ones for that the southern pod of whales eats from Monterey Bay to the Queen Charlotte Islands. We will still serve Chinook when it's available from Copper River, mm-hmm. places like that up in Alaska that are sustainable, but that's how it's going for us. Tina or Sarah, what's next in the news?
Something a little lighter, Tom.
A little lighter. Orcas are pretty heavy.
Yeah.
It's true, especially in comparison to an avocado.
Yeah.
So New Zealand is experiencing an avocado shortage right now, which means that people are stealing them. So there are a lot of – you can grow avocados naturally in New Zealand, I guess, due to the climate. So there are avocado trees, and people are going to local avocado trees and pulling them off and just stealing them from the orchards because of the shortage of avocados. So I thought maybe we could talk about some other foods you can use in place of avocado for things like your toast so that you can stop stealing other people's fruits.
Butter. It's the first thing that comes to mind. Just more butter.
My wife makes avocado tomato toast this time of year every morning, right? We make the beautiful yeasted cornbread at the Dahlia Bakery, and she toasts it up, spreads it with avocado, and then puts fresh sliced tomatoes on top. What could you put in place of the avocado? I would say almond butter. Would almond butter and tomatoes go okay? You can do like a pea hummus.
You know, if you do some fresh peas and make a hummus with that and just put a pea hummus, you'll have the textural kind of context of an avocado. And
the olive oil in the hummus creates the fat.
Right.
Yeah.
So you will have something that will be comparable in terms of texture, a little bit different in flavor, but not that much. I mean, it's you know, think of something green that you can puree and make into a hummus. And
so you think it has to be green to take the place
Well, I mean, that's the first approach. So, you know, you can't make it blue because they're going to go, that's not avocado.
How about baba ganoush?
Yeah,
baba ganoush
would be perfect.
That. Harsh roasted eggplant, burnt on the outside, so that when you peel the skin off, that smoky flavor is just as leached into the meat. You get that nice smoky baba ganoush with fresh tomatoes. That would be good.
That would be delicious.
Perfect. What about cream cheese?
Tahini.
Also very good, maybe a little less healthy, if that's what they're going for.
I guess the dairy compared to avocado oil is considered less healthy, but who knows?
Maybe. Yeah. It was good.
I'd always heard that two glasses of wine was good for you, that you had to stop there, which was a struggle for me. Now it came out this week, no alcohol is good for you.
Dang.
So I'm going to die soon. It's been nice knowing you all.
But wine is not alcohol.
Oh, it's fruit juice.
It's juice,
exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, it's grape juice, for Christ's sake.
You need it.
All right.
So along those lines of charring your eggplants, there is an article that came up on Bon Appetit this week about what is the difference between charring something and just straight burning it. Like, where is the line between a nice charred vegetable versus just something that's burnt?
I experienced that a few times in restaurants where they go charred green onion and your stuff is like past charred.
So it's ash. I mean, ash is a big thing right now. Leek ash, green onion ash.
Good for them.
It's not for you, huh?
No.
You started at the Frenchies with all the ash-covered cheeses.
Well, that's not the same thing.
No, oh.
That's not the same thing, Tom.
Oh, what kind of ash is that?
That's an ash that is aged into the cheese and made into a processing into the cheese. We're talking about a raw vegetable that you just grilled to death, and then you put that on my plate.
Yeah.
And I'm like, really? You could have stopped 5 minutes ago. It would have been delicious. I mean, that's... That's all I can say. I like to still taste the green onion when you bring me charred green onion. To me, it's like it needs to have some nice, beautiful, deep, rich mark of the grill, but not like calcinated beyond belief. I mean, I'm not trying to eat carbon.
Well, what about, say, roasted peppers or like the eggplant I just spoke of, where take the skin and you severely burn the skin.
But then you remove
the skin
it.
Off,
yeah.
But you're tasting the burnt flavor on the flesh that's left.
Correct. But you're tasting it, but you're not eating it. Where the difference with most of the stuff where people make like a swoosh of charred green onion on the plate. It sounds really romantic, but no, thank you. That's just me.
You know, it's interesting you say that because so many people feel like French pastries are burnt. You know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah,
right?
Yeah,
in America,
yeah.
We like them a little bit more blonde.
Yeah.
And in France, when you go and you see like a tarte au poivre or something.
Even
like
a croissant. They're usually very dark brown, that's because they're cooking it all the way. That's a different... Okay, so let me tell you the difference between... Again, the difference
croissant's
between...
Croissant's a little different. I'm talking about like the burnt edges on a pear tart.
The difference between charred and burned. That's the difference. Mm-hmm. That's what she's talking about. And the tart is not burned. It's just nicely... roasted, charred, lightly.
But you do see that kind of thing on like a nice sourdough that comes from a brick oven. You'll see like it'll be a little charred on the outside.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, on the bottom.
Oh, yeah.
You know who used to do that bread just so fantastically was the Italian guy who went to California who invented those.
Ciro.
My God, his bread.
The panzanella.
His bread was just so fantastic. The bottom was always lightly charred. And it was delicious. It makes such a wonderful crust. You test the wood and everything. Oof.
Okay.
All right. So it seems like the main difference is just flavor profile as far as...
Yeah, it's kind of what your palate can handle. It's a little bit like chilies. You like a little hotter or a little less hot.
Mm-hmm. I think I'm a char weenie.
All right. Well, moving on to the next one, also from Bon Appetit. They're talking about why, when we love all things dairy, are we still eating low-fat milk and cheese and yogurts?
I'm with you.
And what is their theory? That it's been proven that it's not bad for you, or you should just eat less and eat full fat?
That it's been proven that fat isn't as bad for you as, say, sugar, and that we are still just holding over from older times this idea that we should be eating low-fat foods, such as yogurt. Do you guys eat anything low-fat? Like, maybe not your restaurants, but at home, do you buy low-fat yogurt or anything?
No.
Full
that's
fat.
Fat all the way.
It's, to me, my philosophy is you either do it or you don't do it. But it's somewhere in between to traffic and change the format of your food is absurd.
I found that a lot of low-fat things, the flavor was substituted with sugar, right? Because fat is flavor generally.
Right.
And so that's when you ended up with all these low-fat things that actually have the same amount of calories. And that gets to the point of if you're counting calories, calories in, calories out, right? So... no matter what it is, whether it's full fat or low sugar or whatever, the amount of calories you put in the body is the amount that you have to burn to get them off, right?
So yeah, and the one thing to remember always is it's not because there's a pint of ice cream then you have to eat the whole thing.
No.
Everybody goes like, yeah, no, you have to.
No, chef, take that back.
Well, I'm just saying, you know, you pay the price at the door. That's very simple.
Mm-hmm. Well, as Julia Child would say, everything in moderation, including moderation.
Exactly.
So, it's one of my favorite quotes of hers. Do you know who Julia Child is? I know you're a youngster.
Believe it or not, yes. I've got that one down, at least.
All right. Good. Up next, it's time for Food for Thought Tasty Trivia. I believe Janet is going to join us from here at the Hot Stove Society. And we are hosted by the Geeks Who Drink. They do trivia nights at Assembly Hall. And we're going to find out who that is. Who's going to come and join us here in just a second on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. You're smack dab in the middle of it. And Tina's over there on the mic. She's going to administer our quiz today. And we have Ken Brill here. He's part of the group that's called Geeks Who Drink. And they do trivia nights at Assembly Hall and at the Brave Horse Tavern. If you just look at our website, you can find out what nights they are if you want to come check it out. Tina, do you want to tell us the rules of the game?
Yes, here's how the game is played, y'all. Everybody gets five questions. Whoever gets all five correct or the most correct is the winner. Whoever gets the least answers correct is the loser. And that loser needs to give something away to either a member of our audience or someone who has asked a very intriguing question on our Facebook page. Today you'll be playing for Callista Wabash. And she asked all about the poached egg. We learned a lot from her question. So
I was going to play for Don, the guy that's never coming to our restaurants.
Yep.
But since he's not coming, I'm not going to give him a free dinner. So.
We're playing for Callista and Don, who won't ever join you. All right, so Chef Thierry, should you lose the quiz today, I mean on the very rare occasion, what would you give away to Callista?
I think I'm going to give brunch for two at Luke.
At Luke, lovely.
Because we have some nice Benedict that she can see how poached eggs are made.
It's a perfect
time. She can actually come in the kitchen and look at it, how we make it.
Beautiful. All right. Janet is playing today in lieu of Miss Katie O. Janet, should you lose, and I don't think you will, but if you do, what would you give away?
I have two spots to Italian desserts. Our class with Bridget Charters, who is an Italian expert, and that is on 9/11, and I think that it's a good time to come visit and forget about all the things that happened on 9/11. So
have dessert instead.
Come in and have dessert instead.
Yeah. Lovely. Chef Tom Douglas, what will you give away if you lose today?
Well, since I'm owner of Assembly Hall and Brave Horse Tavern, you can bring yourself and nine of your friends. That's a party at 10.
What?
Party at 10 to Trivia Night, Geeks Who Drink, on one of those evenings that they're available, and I will buy you a beer and have a good time.
All right, Ken from Geeks Who Drink, take it away.
All right, our first question. What hellish element is found in the compounds that make you cry when you chop onions?
I can't think of it. Oh. So I'm going to give up on that. What is it?
Sure. If you associate elements with the brimstone, you might be thinking of sulfur. It's sulfur in the onions. Snap peas are a cross between garden peas and what cousins that, despite their name, you can totally harvest in the spring?
Chickpea.
Ooh, that is a good guess. However, it is incorrect. It is a snow pea.
Oh, yes.
Aromatic bergamot oil provides the distinctive flavor of what kind of tea?
Earl Grey.
That is correct.
Of course.
We go.
I knew
our
that.
First point. Of
it
the
is,
afternoon.
It is one of the ingredients of
I thought it was bergamot tea.
All right, finally, I do have a multiple choice question for you. Maybe this, at least we'll have a guess this time. Your fourth question. The Greek dish, taramosalata.
Oh, yeah.
Is that made with the eggs of a bird or the eggs of a fish?
Fish.
That is correct. 2 points. Well done.
I need one more question to be done.
You do get one more question, and, well, we are Geeks Who Drink. Not all of our questions will be food-related if you do show up at these events. So let's see how you do on our last question of the round, your fifth question. In 2014, Nicki Minaj teamed up with Drake and Lil Wayne on a track named for what decadent food stuff?
Anybody in the audience know this? Nobody in the audience know this. Oh, my God. Food. You don't know?
The what? Cake?
Sarah doesn't know? Oh, my God.
You got a clue back there. Cake.
Cake.
That is a decadent food stuff. That isn't the correct one. More decadent. Hey, there we go.
Truffle.
It is, in fact, the title of the track was Truffle Butter.
Wow. I have not heard that song yet. I need to get with my Nicki Minaj.
Why hasn't that been a lead-in for our show?
You don't want to know it, John. apple butter is.
Oh. It may not be food they are referencing.
Oh. All right, we'll pass on that.
All right.
Let's get on to the appetizers.
Ew.
All right, Janet, you're next.
Oh.
Our next question said, are you ready?
Yes.
Okay, here are your questions. Your first question. Evolution is pretty weird. That's why the closest living relative of the T-Rex is what ubiquitous animal found on your dinner plate?
I'm going to say the alligator.
No, the chicken.
It's a chicken.
No.
Yeah. Yes, because evolution is super weird. All right, here's question number two, your second question. The British name for sausages baked in Yorkshire pudding batter refers to what amphibian in the hole?
Frog in the hole?
That's pretty close. It is a toad.
Toad in the hole.
Same, Jeff.
She did
Same
not
thing.
Really know, but that's pretty good.
I had no idea.
We'll give it to you.
I'm thinking pigs in a blanket.
We have a tiebreak point there if we need to use it. How about that?
There you
go. All right, maybe we've gone too fancy. Let's try something a little different. Question number three for you. Basically, Spanish for thingamajig. What Mexican dish supposedly began as a burrito accidentally knocked into a pan of hot oil?
Chalupa?
Chimichanga?
Chalupa? Taquito?
Yes. A chimichanga, the correct answer. We heard it back there. At least our audience is following along. I'm glad we're not stumping everybody.
Somebody else should come up here.
All right. You need to get these last two.
Oh, pressure.
To stay in the running here.
Okay.
So
right.
your fourth question.
Yes.
Celery, seasoned tomato, and mixed vegetable were a few disastrous past flavors of what Kraft dessert brand?
Cheesecake.
I can only think of one thing.
Cheesecake.
It's Jell-O.
Yeah,
Jell-O.
Those are former Jell-O flavors.
Oh.
All right, one more question for you. This one is a multiple choice question. You have two options here. We'll see.
Okay.
Maybe that'll get us where we need to be. Your question, I'm just going to name this food stuff for you. Kazu Marzu. Is that a cheese fermented with live insect larvae? Or is it a chocolate bar with a crunchy cricket center?
I'm going to go with the latter. Chocolate.
That is incorrect. All right.
50-50 chance.
So one answer.
Did you know that?
All right. We've got one more set. Are you ready?
Okay.
Okay. We'll start with a 50-50 question
for
you.
Who wants a $25 gift card?
Nobody.
Okay, come over here. You're my partner.
Hey, wait a minute.
He's buying up the
audience. I'm buying up the audience.
Who wants?
So you get a $25 gift card because I can tell just by listening to the first two of these that I'm screwed.
I got Jell-O right.
Did you get Jell-O? So what's your name?
Julie Bishop.
Julie, do you want to cheat with me?
Yes.
Okay,
I do.
Good. We're going to put these guys down.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay,
now it's 2-on-1, Mr. Geeks Who Drink Smarty Pants.
Well, I wish I brought harder questions. All right, here we go. Your first question is a 50-50. And just tell me true or false. Cherry the wood and cherries the fruit come from the same tree.
I do not believe so.
I believe so. So what's it going to be?
You rule.
Because I use a lot of cherry wood in my cooking, and I know it's from orchards.
Do you eat the fruit off it?
Yeah.
Okay, then let's go with it.
So the question is that typical or not?
Because is it true or false?
Yes. True.
That is correct. It is true.
Yes.
Holy cow.
Your second question. What ubiquitous radish is Japanese for big root?
Daikon radish.
It is a daikon, yes.
All the easy ones.
Oh, no complaining.
Oh, come on.
Your third question. Some Primo puddle jumping boots and a beef and pastry dish. They share a name with what fellow who whooped Napoleon?
Napoleon the dessert or Napoleon the warrior?
The dude who could
the
be
dude.
Whooped in battle,
the
yes.
Short French dude.
Yeah. That one.
Do you have any idea?
I do not.
So we're going to assume that meat pie didn't beat Napoleon. So we're going to say pasty. Beat Napoleon.
You're on the right track. It's Wellington.
Oh, Wellington.
The Duke of Wellington.
Duke of Wellington. You know, this segment is only 10 minutes long, just FYI.
Question number four. I'm sure there's some time we can cut out of here. Question four. Because they didn't know any better in the 30s, the American Medical Association gave its first seal of approval to what pasteurized prepared food product?
Velveeta cheese?
Yes.
That is correct.
Yes!
Well
nice
done.
Call. See, it pays to cheat.
There we go. And we have one more question for you. This one is also a 50-50. Good luck. Here is your last question. Which came out first, the movie Soylent Green or that purple people eater song?
The song.
That is correct.
Yeah.
Well done.
All right, Ken Brill, thank you so much. From the Geeks Who Drink, they do trivia nights at Assembly Hall and at the Brave Horse Tavern. Please check online if you ever want to go and be part of that fun group. It looks like Janet lost.
Unfortunately.
So that's two tickets.
Fortunately for our listener.
That's right.
Hello.
Two tickets to Italian Dessert Night here on September 11th. If you want to be part of our show, you can send us a note on Facebook or Twitter at Seattle Kitchen. You're listening to us on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. This show is produced by Tina Noel at Large Media, and our associate producer is Sarah Leibovitz, and our sound engineer is Sean, don't call me Del Torre, darn it. If you'd like to be part of our studio audience, go to hotstovesociety.com and buy tickets for only $15. It comes with hot coffee. Remember, if you miss any episode of Seattle Kitchen, you can subscribe to Stitcher or our podcast through Apple Podcasts or download the Cairo Radio app and search for Seattle Kitchen.
Thanks for listening.